Chapter 8. An African Town. Even with their new freedom, the Clotilda captives were still imprisoned. They were trapped in a faraway land, removed from families and all they had known, desperate to return home, but unable to figure out how to accomplish the task. The Africans had no resources and no support system other than relationships they had built with each other in the days since they left the barracoons of Dahomey. Together, battling through hostility showered on them by both white and black Americans, the Africans fought to make a place for themselves and fought against every effort to oppress them anew in the Reconstruction era. For the Clotilda captives, the desire to return to Africa was the ultimate example of the dream deferred. As they worked toward their shared goal of making a home in their new country, they chose to remain outside of American society, going so far as to set up a community where they controlled everything, even the laws they lived under. Yet despite this desire to be apart, they found themselves repeatedly and dramatically involved in the current events of the day, pushing the boundaries of their new freedom. They boldly confronted their former enslavers and demanded a form of reparations, fought for their right to vote, successfully sued one of the nation's largest railroad companies, built a school for their children because the whites wouldn't give them one, started the area's first church, and created the first and only community in the nation started by enslaved Africans. They suffered through racial violence, murder, disease, and betrayal by people they trusted. All of this in what was then the nation's most intensely racist state, where the very wheels of government continually sought new ways to suppress them. But the Africans did not shrink and hide away among themselves. They fought back. Of course, they had branded themselves as fighters from the start, from the moment they stole the overseer's whip and lashed him with it in Mayor's Field. Everything that happened after that was just a continuation of that first impulse, to fight. Fight for their lives, their rights, their future, and their children. The first move for the Africans on Burns Mayor's plantation 40 miles upriver was to rejoin the 50-plus Africans who had been enslaved by the Mayors and Foster in Mobile. We know something about their journey from a violently racist article published in Confederate Veteran magazine decades after the war. It was written by a soldier who was on board one of the boats as Timothy Mayer retreated with the flotilla to Selma. The piece describes how the vanquished rebel soldiers tormented the newly freed people they encountered floating downriver toward Mobile in pirogues or on homemade rafts. In one instance, soldiers pulled a freedman from his dugout canoe and whipped him aboard the steamboat. Heading downriver would have been the lot of the 20 Africans who lived upriver at Burns Mayer's plantation as they tried to rejoin the larger group at Magazine Point. At least the first part of their journey must have occurred by boat, as it was impossible to reach Mobile from the plantation without crossing the Tombigbee River. Floating downstream to Mobile would have been the easiest way to make the 40-mile trip, as the river would have carried them all the way to their destination, door-to-door service from one Mayer riverfront property to another. In all likelihood, the group was led downriver by James Dennison, the Native American riverboat pilot married to Conco. But if he did lead them, Dennison wasn't with them long once they arrived at Magazine Point. On April 19th, he left behind his African wife and their son to join the army. He enlisted in the 47th Infantry of the United States Colored Troops, one of the units that had helped win the final battle at Blakely 10 days prior. He signed up for a 3-year hitch. The only known picture of James was taken at this time, in his new uniform. He is 25, a handsome, dark-skinned man with piercing, deep-set eyes. His hair, usually worn in 2 long braids, was cut short for his entry into the Union Army. He would only serve about a year before being discharged. In the biography written by his granddaughter, she reports that he tended livestock in the army and contracted rheumatism, diarrhea, and fever from exposure and drinking the unwholesome water of the rivers and swamps due to his army affiliation. Meanwhile, all of the newly free black Americans seemed on the move. Numerous accounts following the South's surrender describe a sudden exodus of the freed, some searching for loved ones in other places, some looking for work, and some just trying to put as much distance as possible between themselves and places they desperately wanted to leave behind. The Africans wanted to move as well, back to Africa. In their first days of freedom, they set their goal as raising enough money to hire a ship to carry them home. They agreed that the mayors and Captain Foster should use one of their boats and return them where they'd found them 5 years before, but knew that even asking the mayors was a lost cause. "We think we save money and buy the ticket ourselves. So we tell the women, 'Now we all want to go back home. Somebody tell us it take a lot of money to carry us back into Africa soil. Therefore, we got to work hard and save the money. You must help too. You see fine clothes, you must not wish for them.' The women tell us they do all they can to get back in their country, and they tell us, 'You see fine clothes, don't you wish for them neither.' Of course, after 5 years in the rough-hewn slave clothes they'd been provided, fine clothes would have been a modest wish. It's likely they were in something close to rags by the war's end, even though they'd been provided new clothes on arrival 5 years earlier. The privations of the blockade era would not have encouraged many of the enslavers to worry over their prisoners' garments. Most of the men quickly found work with the railroad, a gunpowder factory, or at the mayor's sawmill for $1 a day. Cujo would work at the mill until 1902, mostly chopping down trees and making wooden shingles, while Polly Allen, one of Cujo's next-door neighbors, would spend his days stacking fresh-cut lumber. Others from the Clotilda, including Charlie Lewis, went to work as gravediggers for the funeral home owned by Emma Roche's father when the author was a child. This established the connection between Roche and the Clotilda survivors that led to her book Historic Sketches of the South, which was the first and most definitive account of the Clotilda saga, and included interviews with the last eight survivors. According to local lore in Africatown, during this time the newly reassembled Clotilda passengers lived outdoors for a few weeks on a forested hummock along the Mobile River. Before long, they were renting accommodations at a railroad section house, typically used to house rail workers while they worked on a section of railroad. Then they rented several cabins, though it is unclear from whom. The men went to work mostly at businesses associated with the mayors, while the women embraced the same work many of them would have been doing if they'd never been stolen from Africa, growing vegetables to sell. "They raised the garden and put the basket on the head and go into Mobile and sell vegetable," Cujo recounted, describing the way Africans still carry heavy loads today, on top of their heads. In this fashion, Africatown and its residents became well known in Mobile. It was a 3-mile walk to Mobile, a short stroll by African standards, and mention of the women walking to town with their vegetable baskets balanced on their heads appeared in the press. Importing other traditions from their African home villages, the women swept their yards first thing in the morning and cooked what they grew to sell in hot lunches along the roadside or to the men working in the mills. In the evenings, the men worked crafting African-style baskets from reeds and green branches, which the women also sold. No one was idle as they moved toward their collective goal of returning home. In The Story of the Negro, Booker T. Washington spoke of his personal worries as Reconstruction began regarding how African-Americans just released from enslavement would fit into society. "It did not seem possible that a people who yesterday were slaves could be transformed within a few days into citizens capable of making laws for the government of the state or the government of the nation." And yet, this is precisely what the Africans set about doing as soon as they were free. Almost immediately, in an extraordinary act of self-governance, the group began to build a community for themselves, ruled by the social strictures and systems they had grown up with in their native lands. "We see we ain't got no ruler, nobody to be the father to the rest. We ain't got no king neither, no chief like into Africa. We don't try to get no king, 'cause nobody among us ain't born no king. They tell us nobody don't have no king in America soil. Therefore, we make Gumpa the head. He a nobleman back in Dahomey. We ain't mad with him, 'cause the king of Dahomey destroy our king and sell us to the white man. He didn't do nothing against us." It's a magnanimous position for the group to take regarding Gumpa. After all, he had been a senior member of King Glele's court, a part of the governing class of the warmongering kingdom that had stolen their freedom and killed their relatives. However, they had been through a lot together, with Gumpa suffering alongside them for 5 years. he was as much a victim of Glele as they were, similarly snatched from his homeland and family. The pathos of his one-sentence summary of his fate, "My people sold me and your people bought me," is inescapable. Unlike his fellow shipmates, he wasn't captured in war by a rival king to sell for gold. He was given away on a whim as a gift to a slave trader. The shock and misery of that event must have stayed with him always. One moment standing in Glele's court as a trusted advisor. The next, shackled and led to the barracoons, knowing he would never see his wife, children, friends, or homeland again. He was considered a man of noble birth, and one of the oldest among the group, both facts that, in and of themselves, would typically lead Africans reared in tribal cultures to pick him as their leader. Even after 5 years in America, Cujo was just 24. Many of the others were even younger than he was. Several captured as boys and girls were only 17 at the Civil War's end. Most, like Cujo, had never finished the initiations required in their cultures to pass into adulthood. Their desire to immediately recreate a form of government familiar to all of them, with a respected elder in charge and laws everyone agrees to obey, speaks to their powerful instinct to build a society apart from the Americans, white or black. For the Africans, reassembling a piece of their homeland by living together as a village was a way to reclaim their identity and power. They created a place beyond the insults and ostracizing of mobile society. They created a place where they could be, and more important, feel African. Unlike the American black people who had been born into slavery and never knew freedom or citizenship, the Africans had only been captive for 5 years. Most of them were from Bante, a large market town. Their families back home had been sophisticated business people, accustomed to buying, selling, trading, and the experiences of earning money and owning land. In essence, unlike their newly emancipated American counterparts, the Africans already knew how to be free. Meeting at night after work, the group chose leaders and established rules, and then selected punishments for any of their number who violated those rules. In Barracoon, Cujo speaks at great length about the system of justice among his people. When it came to adherence to the laws, there were no exceptions made for the wealthy or influential. And the punishments were severe, often involving a slow and agonizing death in a public place in the center of town. Cujo said the harsh consequences of theft, murder, and other crimes meant rule-breaking was rare. He said a person could leave a bag with money or other valuables somewhere in the community and know with confidence that it would be sitting there, unmolested, when the owner returned to retrieve it. This was the model for Africatown's earliest governance. With Gumpa serving in the traditional role of king, even without the title, two others of the group, JB and Osakibi, were chosen as judges who would serve as a sort of tribunal for community disputes. The entire group collectively created laws governing how to behave ourselves, Cujo said. If someone broke one of the laws or a disagreement arose among members of the community, a meeting was called for the evening, usually at one of the judges' homes. The entire group would assemble as a sort of Greek chorus to watch over the proceedings. The final punishment was up to the judges, with the group collectively supervising the deliberations to make sure the decisions were just. The system, putting the rule of the town in the hands of carefully supervised judges, would serve the community well. Even with original leader Gumpa long dead, the remaining members of the group still governed themselves in the same fashion 50 years after their arrival. As old as they are, if Charlie, who became chief after Gumpa died, told them they could not do a thing, no matter how strong the desire, they would not disobey, Roche wrote. There were rules against hurting anyone, stealing, and getting drunk, among other stipulations. The Africans would come to be known as strict disciplinarians. If a person was caught stealing, Cujo terminated his relationship with you, remembered John Randolph, a man who grew up in Africatown before the last of the Africans died. Their moral standards were way beyond those being displayed by our current generation. Cujo himself recalls, "When we speak to a man what do wrong the next time he do that, we whip him." There are no accounts of anyone receiving whippings or other punishments, in any of the historical texts or interviews with the Clotilda survivors, but Cujo suggests the group was particularly intolerant of drunks. When we see a man drunk, we say, "Dare go the slave what beat his master." That mean he buy the whiskey. It belonged to him and he ought to rule it, but it done got control of him, he said. One of the Africans' first communal decisions was to ask Timothy Mayer to give them a piece of his land around Magazine Point so they could build houses. He had plenty of land, they reasoned, some of it purchased with the money they had made for him through 5 years of free labor. They appointed Cujo to talk with Mayer. His chance to approach Timothy came when the old captain came strolling through a section of forest where Cujo was chopping trees for the mill. Mayer sat down on a felled log and started whittling on a stick. The conversation occurred where the elementary school in Africatown stands today. Telling the story 60 years later, Cujo told Hurston that his emotions overwhelmed him as he asked Mayer, his former captor, to turn over part of his plantation to the Africans. Describing the scene in detail, Cujo said he stopped working altogether as he fought back tears and tried to speak. When Mayer finally realized he no longer heard the fall of Cujo's axe against a tree, the captain looked up from his whittling to see his former prisoner fighting back tears. "Cujo, what makes you so sad?" Mayer asked. "Captain Tim, I grieve for my home." "But you got a good home, Cujo," Mayer said, referring to the cabins the Africans had rented from the railroad. "Cujo don't want it 'cause it ain't home. Captain Tim, you brought us from our country where we had land. You made us slave. Now they make us free, but we ain't got no country and we ain't got no land. Why don't you give us peace this land so we can build ourselves a home?" Mayer leapt to his feet and thundered at his former slave. In Roche's telling, she says Cujo imitated Mayer in dramatic fashion, suddenly speaking like a character out of the King James Bible the African loved so dearly in his later years. "Thou fool! Thinkest thou I will give you property upon property? You do not belong to me now," Mayer said, adding that he had treated the Africans well and owed them nothing now that they were free. Coming just weeks after the end of the Civil War, this moment was likely the first instance of freed slaves anywhere in the nation demanding reparations from their former masters. While it did not go well, asking Mayer to replace what he had stolen from them was the first instinct for the Clotilda captives. It fit with the style of justice brought from their home villages and reflected their sense that owning land was the highest priority. This was their moment of self-determination, the moment they decided they would fight back and demand their due, even if it was risky. When the fledgling community met to discuss the failed negotiations with Mayer, they decided they would quit saving for passage back to Africa and start saving to buy land so they could recreate their homeland here. It's possible the decision came down to realizing how difficult it was going to be to raise the tens of thousands of dollars it would take to get 80 people back to Africa. At best, it would take years and years to save enough money. Meanwhile, many of them had young children who needed homes immediately. It's also possible that even in these early days, the Africans had begun to worry there might not be anything left to go home to. Most knew the life they remembered had been largely destroyed when they were captured, their friends and family either murdered or sold into slavery and shipped to parts unknown. And if they did go back, what was to stop the Dahomeans from capturing them all over again? Ironically, America was now the one place they knew where they were safe from being captured and enslaved the way they had been 5 years earlier. Living on cornbread and molasses, the group members worked hard and saved. When they weren't at their jobs, they made baskets, farmed their small plots, and hunted in the swamps around Hog Bayou. In a year's time, they had enough to buy a parcel from the Mayers. "They don't take off 1 5-cent from the price for us, but we pay it all and take the land," Cujo said. They divided the land, which consisted of low rolling hills, a creek, and some swampy bottomland, into small parcels, about 2 acres per family. The Africans then worked together as a group to clear the new properties of the dense Alabama underbrush and build houses for each other. Small, simple wood frame cabins with brick chimneys and hearths. The lumber would have come from Mayor's Mill. In some of the houses, the chimneys were connected to two fireplaces, each facing into a different room. The bricks were homemade. Cujo and some of the others had learned how to make bricks during enslavement. Cujo said he was one of the last to have his house built because he was one of the last to marry. We call our village African Town. We say that because we want to go back into Africa soil and we see we can go. Therefore, we make Africa where they fetch us. We here and we got to stay. A plat map from the 1920s shows that Cujo and Gumpa were next door neighbors, each sitting on about 2 acres, with Poli Allen and Osakibi a stone's throw away. This meant that 4 of the central leaders in Africa Town's earliest days were next-door neighbors. Mayor's plantation butted up to the new parcels. The Africans would remain lifelong neighbors with the man who'd enslaved them until Timothy's death in 1892. When Cujo finally built his house, he erected a fence around his property and put in 8 gates as a nod to his native village. The next purchase was made by a group that had been enslaved on Thomas Buford's plantation, about a 10-minute walk through the woods from the property bought from Mayor. Included among the group with Charlie Lewis, his wife, and several other Clotilda couples, was an American-born couple who had also been enslaved on the Buford plantation. Horace and Matilda Eli were the first non-Africans invited to live in African Town. They would not be the last. This group split up the 7-acre parcel, which was about a half mile away from the property purchased from Mayor. It has come to be known as Lewis Quarters, and the 8 neat and tidy homes in the neighborhood are still inhabited today by descendants of the Africans. More of the group bought 2- and 3-acre parcels from the Mayors and other sellers centered around the first purchases. In their expansive gardens, which encompassed most of each family's property, the Africans grew a mix of American crops and several West African plants they were familiar with, such as black-eyed peas and okra, which had become common crops in the South. The produce was sold in town by the women, mirroring the native cultures of the Clotilda captives, where women run the markets and sell the produce even today. Cujo's family was known to grow corn, beans, scuppernongs, a grape native to the American South, and sweet potatoes. There are stories of children being chased by Cujo for stealing peaches from his trees. Poli, living a few hundred yards from Cujo, grew peanuts, cantaloupes, pears, plums, garlic, and okra. The men also hunted and fished for their families, and likely sold some of their catch in the markets along Mobile's wharves. They carved dugout canoes in a style still seen on the water in Benin today, to access the network of rivers and floodplain forests surrounding their village, which are still home to abundant animal populations. Cujo was said to be expert at trapping raccoons, opossums, and other animals using techniques he'd learned in Africa. It is possible, and even likely, that the Clotilda captives owned and used guns for hunting by this point, though there is no mention of it. As they started buying property and interacting with the government and organizations like the Freedmen's Bureau, the Africans, like all newly emancipated black people, had to formalize their names and come up with both a first and a last name. They needed full names to become U.S. citizens, which they accomplished in 1868, less than 3 years after they were freed. And they needed names so they could vote, which they tried to do for the first and perhaps only time in 1874, in one of the most contentious elections in U.S. history, marred by racial violence across the South. It was a bold and dangerous step and required much persistence on the part of the Africans. They told the story to Roche in great detail. It began when Timothy Mayer showed up in the village and began lobbying the Africans to vote the Democratic ticket in the upcoming national election instead of for the Republican Party of the day, Lincoln's party. We can glimpse where Mayer's heart lay in the Democratic Party platform for Pike County, Alabama in 1874. The platform advocated social ostracism of all those who act, sympathize, or side with the Negro Republican Party. Henceforth, we will hold all such persons as enemies of our race, and we will not in the future have intercourse with them in any of the social relations of life. A group of Republicans visited the Africans after Mayer had and promised great rewards would come from voting Republican. Among those rewards was passage of a federal civil rights bill that would guarantee African Americans the right to use public transportation, hotels, and restaurants. I suspect that James Dennison and other American-born blacks in the African's orbit were the visiting Republicans mentioned. The position of the Democratic Party in Alabama was hardly a secret, and blacks overwhelmingly voted Republican throughout the South. One of the consequences of this sudden voting power was a backlash that took the form of the White League, a sort of paramilitary white supremacist organization aligned with the Democrats that had multiple chapters in Alabama. On Election Day in 1874, the group attacked two polling places in Barber County, about 100 miles from Mobile. The population in the remote area was dominated by freed black people who outnumbered whites 2-1 and had repeatedly voted for Republicans by overwhelming margins. In the attack, the White League killed 7 people waiting to vote Republican, injured 70 more, and scared more than 1,000 people from the polling place. While the Africans couldn't know of the day's events as they walked to their polling station, a White League sympathizer sought to similarly disenfranchise them. When Cujo, Polly Allen, and Charlie Lewis arrived at the polling place closest to their homes, they found Mayor waiting. He pointed them out to the poll workers. "See those Africans? Don't let them vote. They are not of this country," Mayor sneered. They were turned away by election officials on Mayor's word, even though they had become citizens. So they headed to another nearby polling place. Mayor, on a horse, beat them there and thwarted them again. This happened a third time, prompting the Africans to pray to God for help. As the Africans headed away from this latest encounter, they resolved to outsmart Mayor. Instead of heading to the next closest polling place, they headed to Mobile, where there were too many polling places for Mayor to guard all at once. Choosing one on St. Francis Street, just around the corner from the now-closed slave markets on Royal Street, they each shelled out a day's worth of wages to pay the $1 poll tax and voted Republican. The Civil Rights Act of 1875 passed the following year, granting all races equal access to public transportation, hotels, and restaurants. As for the surnames the group chose for their American identities, it was common at the time for people who had been enslaved to adopt the names of their enslavers. None of the Africans chose this route. There are no explanations directly from them for this in any of the interviews or articles about the group, but we can safely assume that the last thing they wanted to do was link themselves to their enslavers with something as important as a name. In their native cultures, names carried special meaning and often provided details about their families, where they lived, or their tribe. Cujo picked up the last name Lewis at this time. It was not his first choice. At first, he tried to approximate Western-style names by adding his father's name, Ololue, as his last name. "But it too long for the people to call it. It too crooked like Kasula. So they call me Cujo Lewis," he told Hurston. "During my time in Benin, I heard a new and compelling theory on how Kasula ended up with the name Cujo, which means one who is born on Monday in Fon. An important detail for this discussion is that Cujo could neither read nor write. The spelling of his name as we know it today comes to us from newspaper articles and books written by Americans, not because Cujo himself spelled it that way. While it is possible he was born on a Monday and chose this new name for himself when he arrived in Mobile, Cujo is not much easier to pronounce than Kasula for Americans. His Majesty Dada Dagbo Hunun Huna Tu Geli, the spiritual leader of Benin's native Vodun religion, said he believes the name may have had more significance. He said this seemed especially likely to him given the numerous historical accounts that describe Cujo as being well known for reciting African parables. "Cujo is the sun, which is born on Monday. That's what this name means in our language. As we break it down, though, Ku is death, Jo is liberation. Together it means death is gone, or free from death, or born again. It is possible he said his name was Cujo, but there was a problem with the translation a century ago. If I say Cujo, it is different than Cujo," Geli explained. I think maybe he was talking about himself with that name. Kosala in his homeland was dead, but he still lived in a new life. He was Ku Jo, dead and reborn. A few of the other Africans, such as Osa Kibi, never took American names, but most of the shipmates adopted American names at this time. In fact, for most of the Clotilda's passengers, we know only their adopted American names. Emma Roche interviewed 8 surviving members of the tribe who provided both their African and American names. In a touching moment, the survivors ask Roche to call them by their African names in her book, hoping in some way these names might drift back to their native home, where some might remember them. Cujo's wife Abila adopted the name Celia. Arzuma adopted Livingston. Jaba adopted JB or Jabez. Abache adopted Clara Turner. Shamba adopted Wigfall. Kupoli adopted Polly Allen. Monabi adopted Katie Cooper. And Oluale adopted Charlie Lewis. It does not appear that Cujo and Charlie were related, despite the shared last name. Cujo was quoted several times saying all of his kin died during the raid, and he never says Charlie was a relative in any of his numerous interviews. Still, some descendants of the men in Africatown today insist they were related and refer to them as Uncle Charlie and Uncle Cujo. When it comes to the offspring born in the United States, many of the Africans gave their children both American names to use when they were out in the world and African names, which they used at home. "They would have an African name for us, and my name was Joko," said Eva Allen Jones, one of Polly Allen's 10 children, born in 1894, 34 years after the Clotilda arrived. She knew Cujo, Osa Kibi, Gumpa, and the rest for decades in her youth. At the time of her death in 1993, she was one of the last direct links to the original Clotilda group. She expressed remorse that she did not learn her parents' native tongue, but said the children were embarrassed by the language and their African names. "We didn't recognize those names. We didn't want kids laughing at us for calling those names. But in our homes, we had our names and they'd call Joko and never call me Eva." Cujo was one of the last of the bunch to marry. He'd spent much of his 5 years of enslavement on the steamboat running up and down the river, away from the rest of the group, where he might have found a wife. Everyone else who came from his town was married and had children. He was lonely. "I ain't got nobody," he lamented. He had his eye on Celia. She wasn't married yet either. One day Cujo told her he'd like to marry her. She asked if he thought he could take care of her. "Yeah, I can work for you. I ain't going to beat you," he promised. "I didn't say no more. We got married 1 month after we agreed to it ourselves. We didn't have no wedding." Shortly after their union, the pair decided to convert to Christianity. Free George, who befriended the Africans and tried to help them assimilate soon after their arrival, had been quietly encouraging them to find Jesus since their earliest days. Free George himself had been enslaved until a free woman fell in love with him and bought his freedom with money she earned as a cook. During visits to the plantation, he convinced the Africans to quit dancing on Sundays, even if they wouldn't come to church. "Free George, he come to us and tell us not to dance on Sunday. Then he tell us what Sunday is. We don't know what it is before. Nobody in Afiki soil don't tell us about no Sunday. Then we don't dance no more on the Sunday," Cujo said, with no apparent bitterness. "Free George come help us all the time. The colored folks what born here, they pick at us all the time and call us ignorant savage. But Free George, the best friend the Africans got, he tell us we ought giddy the religion and join the church." The Africans fervently embraced Christianity, but they did not want to attend one of the established churches in the area. Cujo said they didn't want to mixy with the other folks what laughed at us. Too many of the members of those churches mocked the Africans for the way they spoke and the habits that identified them as foreigners. Instead, the Africans decided to build themselves a church where they could worship without scorn. The first version of the church was a brush arbor in a clearing next to Cujo's house. In time, they built a classic wooden church with a steeple and bell and called it the Old Landmark Baptist Church. Today, the sturdy brick edifice of the Union Baptist Church sits on the same spot, About 100 yards away stands a brick chimney that used to be attached to Gumpa's house. It is the last structure built by the Africans that is still standing. Cujo's land lay in between the church and Gumpa's chimney. The decision to adopt a new religion must have been emotional for the Africans, many of whom had been vetted in some version of Benin's native Vodun religion, which centers on various animal spirits and a reverence for nature and ancestors. While it is clear they never fully abandoned their old ways, their commitment to Christianity was serious, and the Africans and their children were baptized just down the hill from the church in Three Mile Creek. Cujo served as a sexton at the church until his death, and Roche remarks that during her interviews, Poli's constant companion is a small, much-worn New Testament. I don't know of no other place they went for enjoyment but the House of Prayer. They'd have service there every Wednesday night, every Friday night, and every Sunday night. On Sunday morning, 4 o'clock, we went to a prayer meeting. It was black dark. We stayed until sunrise. Called that sunrise meeting, recalled Eva Allen Jones of her childhood in the early 1900s. Jones was one of the last children born to one of the original founders. After sunrise, we came back home, ate our breakfast, and 9 o'clock, we went to Sunday school. We stay until 11 o'clock service, and after that was over, we went home and ate our dinner. At 3 o'clock, that bell ring, we went back to church. Went home, ate our supper. At 7 o'clock, we was right back in church. Cujo and Celia had their first child 10 months after their marriage, and had 5 more in short succession, for a total of 5 boys and 1 girl. The other couples in the village also had many children. Soon it was time for a school for the children, something unknown in their villages back home, and unknown for most blacks across the South at the time. The first classes were held in the newly constructed church. But before long, the community built a schoolhouse on land donated by several of the Clotilda families. We Africans try raise our children right. When they say we ignorant, we go together and build a schoolhouse. We African men don't wait like the other colored people till the white folks giddy ready to build us a school. We build one for ourselves. Cujo's statement, "We build one for ourselves," sums up the ascendance of the Africans in the years after they were freed. They were not going it alone like most people who were newly emancipated and left vulnerable to the machinations of a white population growing more hostile toward them by the year. Instead, the Africans' decision to band together, govern themselves, and share resources and labor elevated them. Within a few years of gaining their freedom, they were living in houses they built themselves, worshiping in a church they built themselves, sending their kids to a school they built themselves, and doing it all in a village they built themselves. A village where they had significantly more autonomy than most who had been freed by the Civil War. By the 1880s, the children of the Clotilda passengers began to marry and build small houses in the community, often on their parents' parcels. American-born black people were attracted by the growing reputation of African Town, a place not ruled by whites, and began moving to the area. By then, popularly known as Plateau because it was built at the top of a slight hill above the river, the town was far enough from Mobile at about 3 miles that the land was cheap, especially so because the peninsula the town was on was surrounded on 3 sides by swampland. Meanwhile, the death of Timothy Mayer in 1892 reminded the nation of the story of the Clotilda and kindled new interest into what had become of her passengers. Obituaries in the Mobile Daily Advertiser and Register, the New York Times, and papers all over the nation described Mayer as the venerable steamboat man and swashbuckling. But most of the ink in every obituary was spent telling the story of the Clotilda and the creation of Africatown. Many of the obituaries included descriptions of the settlement, such as this from the hometown Daily Advertiser and Register. They mix very little with other Negroes and preserve many of their native customs, using their native language, speaking English with difficulty and being ruled by a queen of their own choosing. They enjoy a high reputation for honesty and industry. While it is unclear where the local paper got the notion that Africatown was ruled by a queen, the renewed interest directly inspired Alabama poet and author Mary McNeil Scott to visit Africatown for the first time, where she interviewed Noah Hart, whose recollections have proven invaluable. Scott's 8 novels, published under the pen name Sidney McCall, were well received in their day, and her poetry, often centering on flowers, was published in newspapers across the country. The article under consideration here, titled Ithaca Town, was also published widely. It includes the only interview conducted with Noah Hart, who as Timothy Mayer's houseboy had a front row seat to the Clotilda story. Scott wrote the breezy feature after her pretty New York cousin came to town and asked to visit an African village near here. I have heard it spoken of so often.